Well, I will start my our presentation with an experimental and a computational investigation of bonding between aflatoxin B1 and the SMAC titer. I would like to introduce my co-authors, Marek. Marek is a Polish graduate student, and he got involved in this project because of his strong skill with computation science. Also, Anna Brentes and Marilu, they are in the audience. And Frank is from Hungary. He has done some theoretical calculation when we found his literature, so we invited him to this to our project. He has done quite a bit of work for us. And Dr. Joe Dixon is in this audience too. Aflatoxin is a metabolite produced by fungus. In this case, we have Aspergillus florus and also other fungus, they can produce aflatoxins. In nature, there are about 16 or more of the aflatoxins. Aflatoxin B1 is the most toxic aflatoxins. This is the structure of aflatoxin because it is a fluorescent blue under UV light. So we call it aflatoxin B1. B stands for blue. And also we have aflatoxin G1, means G green color, etc. And here is the crystal of aflatoxin when precipitated out from a solution. There are very serious health effects to both human and animals. In this example, is from Anna's experiment. She is going to talk about more later. Unless we have two chickens, both of them are 3 weeks old. On the left is the chicken fed with clean corn. On the right side is the aflatoxin fed with aflacontaminated corn there. You can see a huge difference there. There are a lot of preventive measures in the field during the growth or harvest, and but sometimes those technologies may fail, so we have to come out a correct measurement method to prevent the toxicity of aflatoxin. Our approach, started by Dr. Joe Dixon about 7 years ago, basically is to use clay minerals to detoxify aflatoxin. So the reason we choose bentonite here because bentonite are economically feasible. It's very cheap. This costs $30 to $60 one ton. And we really don't need much for the animal feed or human consumption. And also socially acceptable because people have been eating clays for thousands of years. So socially acceptable. Actually, people do use clays as a supplement for animal feed. I will have a diagram showing those percentage. And also because it is environmentally friendly, we can find smectite everywhere, almost in every soil. So this diagram shows the bentonite use in 2006 in USA. And then we can see there are 3% of bentonites actually are used in animal feed. So what we needed to do is just to find the correct bentonite to detoxify aflatoxin or other mycotoxins. And recently, my colleagues at Texas A&M University has started some human clinical trials. Basically, made those capsules, and he has done some experiments in both USA and in Africa. He had found very promising results on detoxifying aflatoxin and also other mycotoxins there. The question for us is, we know bentonite has a huge distribution around the world. Here is a diagram, is the 2008 bentonite production map. USA and China probably are the two biggest countries to produce bentonites. And also we do have some bentonites from South America, Europe, Australia, so they are broadly available. The attractive part for using bentonite to detoxify aflatoxin is this. They are cheap, they are locally available, so it should be a very practical measure for people to use it for animal feed or for human clinical trials. But the question is, what are the most important mineralogy properties in determining aflatoxin binding capacity? What kind of minerals we want to have? For those don't have high adsorption capacity, how do we improve the adsorption capacity? Unless we know bentonites, smectites can absorb a lot of organic compounds. There are a lot of papers in the literature have dealt with that interaction between organic compounds and minerals. So how do we improve selectivity of the bentonites for aflatoxin. So to answer those questions, we need to understand the binding mechanism between aflatoxin and the semagtite. So basically, this is the major objective of today's talk. The approach we used are two approaches. We have both experimental data and also some molecular computation data. For experimental data, we have used X-ray diffraction and for related to this topic, mostly infrared data. For computational data, we have bond length, atomic charge, infrared spectra, and with the density function theory at the PCM, B3L, PDGD, ZVP level of theory. I will not pretend I understand the computation chemistry. If our audience have any questions about the calculation, I will email those questions to my co-authors. This clay we used is a Texas Gonzales bentonite. We separate the less than 2 micron clay fraction. It's relatively pure. It has a little bit of opacity in it. So in the first experiment we did, if we aflatoxin can go to the interlayer of the smectite or not. So we measured the displacement between those layers. We found out without reacting with aflatoxin, the smectite will collapse about to 10 angstrom once we heat up the sample to 150 Celsius degrees. Right? But when we react in that sample with aflatoxin, and it still stayed about 13 angstrom until about 400 Celsius degrees. So we have confidence that aflatoxin can go to the interlayer of the smectite. Question is that, how do aflatoxin react with smectite? Because if we look at the molecular structure of aflatoxin, actually it's quite simple. It's just carbon, hydrogen, and a lot of oxygen here. From the literature we have read so far, we think most important reaction atoms on aflatoxin are those oxygen atoms. So here we have carbonyl oxygens, we have the furans and oxygen there, we also have methoxy groups in there. So which oxygens are most important in bonding between aflatoxin and the smectite? So this is the first question we want to answer. The second question is how do they react with the smectite? Based on literature, we think most important reaction mechanism is between the exchange of cation and those oxygens there. So how do we prove that? So the first approach we did to ask this question, which atoms, oxygen atoms, is the most important atom in the bonding? There are few possible ways to interact those oxygen to interact with the exchange of cations, such as carbonyl oxygens, furans, and also in this way, or we may have simultaneous several reaction spots on the molecule. So how do we tell which one is the most important one? So we did a theoretical calculation about the charge, atomic charge. What we found out, two carbonyl oxygens are most electrically charged. If we calculate the electrostatic potential on the molecule, we found those blue ones means the most electrically potential on the molecular surface, and the red ones the most positive one. So we found out the two carbonyl oxygens had the lowest electrostatic potential. So this gives us a theoretical base that those two carbonyl oxygens are the most important oxygens in the bonding between aflatoxin and the smectite. We also did some molecular mechanical modeling. Those data are not the ideal case, and we are not very happy with the results, but they do give us enough information about some specialty between aflatoxin and smectite. So in this case, what we have, this is just half of the 2-to-1 layer structure up and down. We have some exchange of cation and a few aflatoxin and some water molecules there. So on the left side, we have water in the interlayer. On the right side, we don't have water in the interlayer. What we can see here is in the presence of water, most of those exchange of cations are also surrounded by water molecules. So if the aflatoxin react with those exchange cations, must be through those water molecules. This is in the presence of water. But when there's no water in the interlayer, what we can see here, you see, let's exchange cation react with two carbonyl oxygens very closely, and here too, right? But most, in some places, we also found out those may react a little bit closer to those furans oxygens. So this molecular dynamic simulation suggests that those carbonyl oxygens are the most important ones in the bonding. So this is our hypothesis about the bonding mechanism. In the presence of water, the carbonyl oxygens react with water through hydrogen bonding in the hydrogen shell of the exchangeable cation. Without water, unless direct ion-dip interaction or coordination between the exchangeable cation and the oxygens. Those are our hypothesis. How do we prove that? We do have a theoretic data and also experiment data to prove that. So here is on the right side is a diagram about the bond length change. What we can see here, those carbonyl oxygen bond stretch the longest, the 16, 18, and 21, 22 atoms, both are those two carbonyl bonds there. So they stretch the most. And also for those two 21, 15, which means those ones, nearby ones, they stretch and they kind of much shorter. So this the bonding length change. And also on the atomic charge, we also found out that oxygens, those two carbonyl oxygen, get more active when they interact with cations, when we increase changes from molybdenum cations to davenant cations, and also to the transition heavy metals there. So we also did an infrared calculation. At the very bottom, those bars means intensity, and here those marks means water, or we have exchangeable potassium, sodium, calcium, magnesium, and manganese. Right, so what we want to show you here is a few examples. The first one is this band. We do see a red shift. A red shift means the frequency shifted from the high frequency to lower frequency here. So this band at this position about 17.73 for the water, if we have water in the interlayer, will be at this position. But this band will shift to lower frequency. This band is corresponding to the in-phase carbonyl, two carbonyl stretching vibrations. And of course, we have another red shift observed on 1699, this band. This band is in the opposite phase stretching of those two carbonyl bonds there. So what we can see, when we have a stronger interaction between the exchange of cation and those carbonyl oxygens, those bonds will be weakened. So when that happens, that bond will shift to lower frequency. This is our interpretation. But also from a theoretical calculation, we did find out that we still have some bonds shift to higher frequencies. Those are called the blue shifts. So those are shouldn't be related to the carbonyl oxygen bonds there. So this one mostly related to deformation of this max group here. And also have another example here. So this one also related to deformation as vibration of that molecule. So based on this, we can see we do have some hint that if we replace the exchange cations, and then those rare infrared bonds should shift. So this is what we did in the lab, try to replace the exchange cations. What we did, we replaced the calcium with non-different cations. Here we'll include the calcium here again, because try to get the same washing effect in this experiment. So what we did, we first got an aflatoxin reacted smectite, and then reacted with all of those non-different salts. And then I draw it as on a zinc sulfide window, and then run the infrared pattern. So this is what we observed in the lab. We can see when they are air-dried, the potassium saturated aflatoxin is a white color, but the copper saturated aflatoxin is a yellowish color, yellow-brown color, right? But when we exposed them to high humidity, about 100% humidity, often have very close color, to white color. So we do think humidity will affect the bonding mechanism, and also exchange of cations do affect the bonding mechanism there. So for the experiment, the infrared spectra, here we have the dry humidity infrared pattern. What I want to see, we did observe two, actually several of those red shifts and blue shifts. Those red shifts from the in-phase carbonyl stretching band, and then light one from the opposite phase stretching vibration from the carbonyls. And here, with those blue ones are those deformation stretchings, vibrations. So those experimental data matched the theoretical calculation very well. So we do have confidence about our bonding mechanism. So at 100% humidity, we didn't observe much difference among those different cations. So that means water did play a very important role when we have high humidity in that environment. So to summarize, we can see they can, aflatoxin can go to the interlayer, they can be bonded to the smacked by ion dip interaction and a relatively high dry humidity, and also can bond to the clay through water bridging when we have high humidity. So in conclusion, the two carbonyl groups of aflatoxin B1 play the most important roles in bonding, and ion dip interactions or coordination at low humidity is the most important bonding mechanism, and water bridging and high humidity is the important one. So what's the practical importance of this type of research can be used for? I think if we want to achieve high selectivity, we can select adequate charge density or adequate exchange of cations. We can play around, try to fit, match the size of the aflatoxin with the nanometer scale domains on our clay mineral surfaces. Right, so on the last slide, I would like to acknowledge our funding for agencies and some special thanks to Duke Dixon for his soil mineralogy endowment. Okay, I think probably, do I have time for questions? Okay, one short question. Yes, Chris.
I was curious, when you saturate the cations, how were you about a fourth of the CDC, half the CDC, and where were you at in terms of loading?
All right, Chris' question is how do the cation exchange, what kind of a level for cation exchange we did? Basically, we saturated the aflatoxin smectite with those different cations. We used a very high concentration for calcium, sodium, potassium, all of those cations, and we washed it three times, so it's fully saturated. The amazing thing is this, aflatoxin is still on the clay. We can still see it on the infrared patterns. So once it is absorbed, it's very, very stable. The question is how can we get it in the first place? This is the most challenging part. So this our team is working on right now. Right, thank you.